signal strength.
On August 19th, I sat down with documentary filmmaker and producer Don Langford. Don grew up in D.C. and has worked on powerful, socially resonant documentaries, most recently The Body Politic, which aired nationally in theaters and on PBS in 2024. The movie follows Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott in the first year of his mayorship as he changes Baltimore policing, resulting in a dramatic reduction in crime. This was great backdrop for our conversation about Trump's performative occupation of Washington, D.C. Here's my conversation with Don. Hey, Don.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. We are here at the beach in Delaware. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's great.
And thank you for coming and hanging out with my family and I on our vacation.
Thanks for having random black lady on your vacation for a couple of days. Love that.
Very glad to. Well, when it's my wife's best friend and my,
yes.
my old friend now, like 10
That's
years.
That's right. It's 10 years.
It's a good thing. And frankly, makes it easier with the kids and everything just to have another person
good.
Around.
Well, they're hilarious.
They
your,
are.
Your kids are great.
Yeah. Thank yeah. you. So let's talk about crime in D.C. and Baltimore and other things that are related to it. My co-host and I, Rob, are just trying to address how the Democrats and now really progressives can take power back and and fight what's going on now. And it's getting more and more dire over the course of our the few months that we've been doing this.
Yeah.
Now it's like really dire over the past few days with this new invasion of D.C., which is probably just you know, one more distraction from the disaster of, you know, the tariffs and, you know, that Epstein stuff.
Yeah. Well, I will say at least white people are getting mad now. I mean, just the D.C. class, though, which is, I'm thinking of the sandwich thrower in particular, that he's a new hero.
He is a new hero. Get it?
Hey. yeah, so at least it's not just contained to BIPOC communities in some ways, but, you know, they are the police presence, the federalized police and the militarized police presence is in Northwest predominantly, which is an interesting place for them to be. So they're showing up there, and I'm curious why they're showing up there. They're not in Northeast. They're not in Southeast.
Right.
They're in the most visible areas,
yeah.
And particularly downtown. And then they, of course, are in Mount Pleasant because that's traditionally that's an immigrant neighborhood. In my neighborhood, too.
Sure.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, so they're not in the places where residents have actually been asking for more law enforcement.
Yeah, no, actually, the D.C. police are unable to answer local calls now. So calls that are being made through 311, 911, are basically the D.C. police force are under the orders of the federal
right.
police force. And right. I just read this a few minutes ago, so I'm not able to corroborate that story, but it seems like now it's actually increasing violence and crime, this federal takeover of the city.
Yeah.
So now there's no one's responding to the actual calls, and the, you know, this military presence is mostly for the visuals.
Right.
Yeah. And that they're outwardly lying about the crime rate. It's the crime rate in D.C. is the lowest it's been in 30 years. So yes, are there teen young people who carjack? Yes, that happens on occasion.
Yeah,
I know. So Patrick, we were talking earlier, and that there's a theory that we both share that the whole thing that started this whole thing off was a young man by the name of Big Balls.
Big Balls.
Which is disgusting. And he's he was the Doge, a teenage Doge
right.
henchman.
Right. So, yeah, this kid's first, you know, offense is to come into D.C. and just displace completely thoughtlessly, you know, tens of thousands of people from their jobs with this, you know, pretense of, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse. Just
making shit up, coming in and just generating lists of people to be fired at the, you know, these excuses. So, you know,
how old, obviously he's no not experience. Even 21.
He's 19 years old. Yeah. I mean, this kid has not even like gone to college.
Yes. He's just a kid.
He's a child. And then clearly, you know, in the thrall of Elon Musk and this whole Doge bullshit, you know, another performance, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he's here in DC and yeah. So we have serious questions about whether this was a stage that event and this kid was a crisis actor.
Yeah. I think that we all wanted to punch him in the face. Yeah. So literal, you know, I think that he probably got his, you know, karma. It's, yes. You know, but if it's not staged, well, also we were saying that he probably was being racially offensive and that in DC, you know, if you mind your own business, you're usually going to be fine. But if you say something to somebody, it's done.
Yeah. Yeah. And for context, right, it was 3 a.m. in DuPont Circle, and this kid's 19 years old. The bars in D.C. close at 2 a.m., right? So what are you doing when you're 19 in DuPont Circle, like, and clearly out of your car? I think he was trying to buy drugs, you know? I mean, I can't think of what else you'd be doing.
Well, I don't think there's an open-air drug market necessarily.
But he might not know that,
in DuPont
right?
Circle or anywhere in D.C. anymore. I don't know if... Oh, I don't know, to be honest. But, yeah, I don't know what he was up to.
But, I mean...
He's clearly up to no good.
Yeah, I mean, it's 3 a.m., right? I mean, So, it kind of doesn't matter whether he was a crisis actor or not because Trump got what he wanted out of this event of him getting beaten up. Like he, you know, it was an ideal situation, you know, a white kid getting beaten up by, you know, black youth, right? Mm-hmm.
And I think 15-year-old girls.
Yeah, by some 15-year-old
girls. How it's being described.
Yeah, totally.
And now we have tanks stationed. Well, I haven't seen it, so I haven't been back to D.C. since this happened. So not sure what it looks like.
The fact that he got this violence that he could use as the pretext for this invasion of the city and that it was his own person is suspicious because, I mean, I think one thing that is, which is crazy, is that with all this law enforcement, all this provocation and these masked thugs coming around, I feel like he has been fishing for a violence. Like he's...
He might have.
He wanted to be putting these ICE agents and these National Guards in harm's way because... Any harm that would come to them would be, you know, his pretext for invasion. And then it turned out to be this Doge kid instead. But, I mean, think about how restrained the city has been and how tolerant of this to have this be the only, as far as I know, the only kind of violence towards, you know, any of these kind of these invaders. And I consider this kid one of these invaders.
For sure. Yeah, for sure.
I mean, that's nuts, right? I mean, I think eventually someone is going to shoot one of these masked ICE people, so they're not going to know whether they're a cop or not.
Yeah, no, I think that's...
And they're trying to put you in their van, right?
You know? It seems like a bunch of people wearing masks could just throw you into a van, and no one's going to do anything about it. It's very dangerous. Like, I probably am not going to come back to D.C. for a while. And I need to get stuff and I need to close out my apartment and I need to do a lot of things, but I'm also, I don't want to be at risk because I am a person of color. So,
yeah.
And I feel like now they're sending 200 more troops from Mississippi as well. So there's troops from Ohio, South Carolina, and now Mississippi has jumped on the bandwagon. And any other states that want to curry favor with Trump can do that by sending their army reserves to our nation's capital so they can racially terrorize us.
Right, because the D.C. National Guard and the Maryland National Guard are basically locals, right? So they know that it's a lie.
They know it's a lie.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're part of the problem.
That the lawlessness, craziness. And I mean, to be clear, there is, you know, violence in D.C., you know, and I mean,
for sure.
It's a real issue, you know, and I mean, a lot of people get hurt by it. It would be much better if it was not that way.
Yeah,
you know?
The young people in D.C. have been pretty disadvantaged for a while. I think about it going back to when Michelle Rhee was she had taken over the education department locally, closed several schools that were functioning, that had communities, families, and had no numbers to prove why. And a lot of those schools served a lot of youth locally. And so now in DC, there's a system where it's very hard for a kid to be able to go to a school that's close by. And it just sort of shifted everything around. So, I mean, that happened, that broke up those communities. Mm. And a lot of those buildings are either sitting empty or they've been privatized. They've taken public assets and sold them off. And now they're condos. Like, there's actually quite a few like bespoke condo buildings that used to be these schools.
Oh, that's sad. I didn't know.
Yeah, no, quite a few. And many of them are around Howard University. Yeah. So yeah. There's at least four or five that I can think of. And I used to go by these schools all the time, or I was in the neighborhood and saw like they were vibrant, they were wonderful, they were happy. And I think because they were serving a majority Black youth, they were closed. Mm, so a lot of these youth that are like, I feel like they, you know, they don't have, there's nowhere to go. There isn't necessarily like being schooled in community as opposed to being, you know, considered a problem at another school and just being taught with care. And I think that, and having a community around it helps. And that's not really, I don't feel like that's really an option right now.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to get even worse with this.
Because
they have power over DC. And, you know, I'm part of, you know, this whole, you know, MAGA Republican project. And I wouldn't even see MAGA, because MAGA is not that well thought out. But the long-term Republican project is to eliminate public schooling altogether and move to charter schools and private schools, you know, and vouchers and all that kind of thing. Right. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if that's their next move in DC, since they can't. That's the problem with DC, is that they can do it. You know, they can take control over the city.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I'm sure that that's part of the plan. I don't know if they're going to withdraw the troops at any point. I don't know if that's how long they can, how sustainable that is and how long that's going to go for, how many resources they're going to put into effectively taking it over, and probably misreporting. But the resilience of the DC citizens, I don't think people are going to lie down for it.
No.
I mean, obviously not. And then you've got like some of the people who have been serving our country in civic positions for decades, or they've committed their entire careers to it. And people who are just now entering that, I don't think they're going to lie down for it either. And then we've got enough people who've been privileged for long enough who are very type A and are not going to, like, they're definitely going to fight against it. There's that layer of people. Mm-hmm. So I don't think DC is going to just lie down.
No.
Yeah.
We're not.
I can tell you that right now.
And I've seen it, you know. So did you know that I went viral lately?
Oh, yeah. I heard.
Yeah, I did. I've been,
congratulations.
I've been checking my Instagram every 2 minutes because I had been watching on the news and I had seen all this, you know, personnel carriers and, you know, these troops outside Union Station. It's like, that's ridiculous. You know, like Union Station is not a place where I've ever felt unsafe. I have felt unsafe in DC before, but not right there. And I did used to live right there.
Yeah, they hit that place for a reason. It's high visibility, but also there's generally partial encampments of unhoused people there. So they went to make a big spectacle of removing them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's kind of a national landmark, you know.
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, they're stationed there. They're stationed in all the high visibility areas.
Right. Mm-hmm. But a lot of that, those encampments had already been cleared, or if they already had kind of died down, because there has not been a lot of lately.
Yeah. There's regular sweeps.
Yeah. Like prior to all this.
There's always been the sweeps for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, because I move through there, you know, I ride the transit and, you know, we drive past there all the time. But I thought, you know, I just wanted, this is, you know, a couple of days ago, I just want to see for myself. And I got on the train and I came up and I expected to come up, you know, around all these personnel carriers and all this stuff, but it was all gone. They just completely moved out, you know?
Oh.
And so there's only a few like metropolitan police and, you know, just kind of wandering. Like I came out, if you saw that video, there's actually, when I was coming up out of the station, there was a guy there who was like, looked like he was, you know, had heat stroke or something. And there's a couple MPD like helping him, you know, just like you'd kind of see on an ordinary day. And that was the only thing I saw. And I did see, you know, there are some, there is one encampment, which is like a protest encampment from these, from Flare. And I think there's another group. And I really liked, I sat and talked to the Flare people for a while. And they're like all about making like anti-fascist art and statements like that.
Love that.
Know? Yeah. And then I went over, but there's really nobody around. But I heard that there was going to be something over at Judiciary Square from Free DC. Mm-hmm. And so I went over and sure enough, there were some people at Free DC because they were there to, you know, Pam Bondi had just announced that she was going to displace the chief of police with, you know, the head of the DEA.
Yeah, I saw that.
So people were at MPD, police headquarters to protest that. And they started up and there was, you know, people there. So people are not taking it lying down. And I talked to some of the people, like you said, they're kind of like privileged, you know, type, you know, DC residents who have been a long time who, you know, are not used to this and know that it's ridiculous.
They're outraged.
Yeah, they're totally outraged. And then they were also gearing up, you know, while we were there, it turns out, you know, that we got a hearing scheduled for the judge to hear the challenge that our DC Attorney General had filed to enjoin that order from going through, displacing the chief of police.
That's right. I saw that.
That was right there.
Yeah. Now DC's going to fight. They're going to fight back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we won that. We actually, that was a battle that we won, which I'm sure drove Trump out of his mind, you know.
You know, they might abandon this effort, maybe.
I mean, at least the effort to, you know, completely displace the D.C. chief of police. And so, little victories, you know, are great. Mm-hmm. I recorded my whole little journey down there and I posted it on Instagram. And I said, look, people, like this, look how beautiful the city is, look how clean this metro is, and this is not because of Trump. All this was completely like unnecessary.
Glad you did that.
yeah and I got more views than I'd ever gotten on Instagram, but all these people are like, hey, yeah, well, you know, that was during the day, what about at night, you know? And you know, it's true, like I am not,
is that what they said?
I'm getting comments like that. Yeah, and it's like, you know, I mean, at night, you know, I used to live down there at Union Station. Remember, we lived at 3rd and D, and I would take the metro home late at night, and I would walk that couple blocks. And I would, you know, look behind me sometimes, you know, you know, it's not like crazy, but I mean, I'm not out at 3 a.m. just about ever.
Well, yeah, I think any city at 3 a.m. is, you know, you're definitely tempting fate more at 3 in the morning.
Yeah, especially if you're trying to buy drugs.
Well, yeah, you know, who knows what that little guy was trying to do?
I can't think of any other explanation. I mean, but anyway.
I don't know. I don't know. But it was interesting to see. So Sinclair Media, they are based in the Baltimore area, not Baltimore City, but Baltimore County.
Okay.
And Baltimore County is, it's crazy because it's, essentially, it should be part of the city, and they just don't want to, like, all the people that, like, the developers, people who are making money in the city live in the county, and that way a lot of tax revenue is not being generated or it stays in the city, and it goes back over the line into the county. Mm-hmm. So Baltimore County extracts wealth from the city.
Right.
The city doesn't get that tax revenue. So it's not showing up in the schools. Mm-hmm. It's not showing up in trash removal. It's not showing up in like tons of things that should. There are entire neighborhoods in Baltimore that have never had public transportation. And we're talking, and so like in Baltimore, white flight happened 100 years earlier than it did in like many other cities. So there are places in that city that have never been invested in. So they've never had access to regular amenities.
Right.
But anyway, Sinclair makes a lot of money by, you know, feeding into the fear of black cities and the fear of like democratically run black cities. So they extract, you know, images, and especially, and it started in Baltimore. Right. And so,
And so people don't know that maybe Sinclair is like this company that bought up all these AM radio stations all over the country.
Worse than that. They own 49% of all the local news affiliates.
That's right. They do. Yeah.
It's like, and then they editorialize it.
Yeah.
So it's like they, it's not just Fox. So they, like in DC, they actually bought WJLA.
Oh, wow.
Which is
Seven on Your Side.
Seven on Your Side. They're still doing a good job, but, and they were called out during, that, you know, that first fateful time that Trump won, that they word for word in 49 local news
made them read off that statement.
Yeah. Verbatim, supporting Trump for president.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been buying more and more. So they probably own more than 49% now. But they make a lot of money through the, you know, like extraction of poverty imagery of mm-hmm. black crime of, and so it's like I travel a lot for work and I'll be in another city and I'll out of curiosity check out the news while I'm in a hotel. Uh-huh. And generally, you know, I will be able to identify which one is the Sinclair station.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Because of how they are. And it's weird because they report on Baltimore crime mm-hmm. in these other cities that don't have anything to do with Baltimore. Like there's no reason.
Yeah, but it's just porn.
But just like, And so, and it's just sort of extracted and used in that way.
Yeah.
And it's, so it's burned in the psyches of many Americans in, you know, all kinds of states all over the country who wouldn't know anything about it otherwise.
Right.
Yeah. And then they used the mayor as an example, Mayor Brendan Scott of Baltimore, when that, and it's completely unrelated to anything that he, that's under his jurisdiction, but a large shipping boat crashed into the bridge, I think their key bridge,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, it had some fatalities as a result of that, and I'm trying to remember who, someone tweeted from, and it was like one of the right-wing newscaster people, and it said, "You're DEI mayor."
Oh my God.
And then it had a, and people love to flip out about his hair as well.
Right.
So he's grown it out and it's like in an afro or something or mini afro. And so they love freaking out about how he looks, about how he talks, the fact that he's younger, looks younger.
Yeah.
He's like under, he's 40 now, but.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Brendan Scott because just to segue, like the reason why I was so excited to talk to you about this issue in this time is mm-hmm. that because you have this perspective based on what you've been doing that just completely puts the lie to the idea that any kind of like big surge of law enforcement in DC is going to solve the problem. Right. Because it's just absolutely not like, you know, there's been, you know, over policing and zero tolerance policing,
mm-hmm,
you know, in big cities for years and years and years. And yet, you know, the violence has just kind of continued to go up.
It just perpetuates the cycle of violence.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it interrupts families.
Yeah.
It creates more trauma. There's several reasons, and I'm glad that you got to watch The Body Politic.
Yeah, yeah, and so you produced this movie called The Body Politic. Yeah, and it's about, what's it about?
We followed the mayor. So we saw, like, at first it was just going to be like an election film, which is a genre onto itself.
Right.
So there's like, who's going to win? And like, you get to know the candidates.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's very West Wing.
Yeah, we had multiple candidates. We're like, you know, each one had their own, you know.
Oh, so you were following other candidates too?
Yeah, we followed. It was interesting because there's two mayors recently of Baltimore who have been charged with federal offenses. So one of them was Sheila Dixon, who was forced out of office in 2016. She was basically definitely doing some things that were not great. She still won't take full responsibility for it. She wasn't fully charged for it. She was running and she really went after Brendan Scott. So Brendan Scott, who did win, we found that the footage was more interesting what happened after he won rather than just him winning. And that that's not really revelatory, and that he only won by 3,000. He barely beat Sheila Dixon, who had to step down from being the mayor. And she's kind of like the Marion Barry almost of Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Like people
love her
and mm-hmm. they don't care what she did wrong, but also there's like an age difference. There's a generational divide. I would say not just with like in like black politics, but like in general, I think. So older Democrats and younger Democrats are not seeing eye to eye. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's more progressive policies.
In every demographic.
So yeah. They're going after him for his age, speaking down like he didn't even have the qualifications. Like mm-hmm. he's so much smarter than than she is, like clearly. Mm-hmm. And the fact like she glosses over the fact that he'd already been in politics since he was 23. So he's already been in office for 13 years. And didn't step down because of
committing. Is he like a city councilman or something like that? Or what was
yeah.
it before? Okay, got
yeah.
it.
Yeah. And also, so there's also like the power culture that I think Baltimore encompassed as well politically. Mm-hmm. So you're living high off the hog. You're, you know, eating off of the dime, the tax dollar dime, and that's like what it's mm-hmm. perceived as. You're going out to fancy restaurants. You belong to the private clubs. You've got the fancy car. You're dressed up. And that's like kind of oddly connected with respectability politics. So, you know, in the black community in particular, you have to like dress the part. Right. That can be left by the wayside as well. So he's challenging a lot of conventions mm-hmm. about like who should be in power, what do they need to look like, what rules are they playing by. He doesn't believe in like performativity as far as like or respectability politics, that if you're black you have to look, if you're not like dressed in, you know, whatever, a suit, like a three-piece mm-hmm. suit or something, that yeah. you're not considered capable or viable. So he just challenged a lot of different notions. He doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke, he never has. He lived in a $1,100 a month apartment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, he had a girlfriend the whole time who he kept out of the limelight.
Oh yeah, you don't see her once. You wouldn't even know that he had a girlfriend.
And yeah, and that he also made sure to keep his, not just from us, but in general, he wanted to keep his private life safe. And that's uh-huh, really yeah. great that he did. Right, it's funny because yeah. Sheila Dixon, they were playing so dirty. They were spreading rumors that he was gay.
Uh-huh, because he didn't have a visible girlfriend.
Exactly.
Which would be part of playing the whole.
Yeah, it was just so dirty.
Yeah. Oh,
and that's so terrible. They were trying yeah. to affect his numbers that way. Yeah, it's very yeah. very contentious. And so it was
but
more
in his
interesting.
Story, like in the movie, you know, he talks about it, having seen his first, you know, shooting before he was 10 years old, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. yeah, so he took completely grew up as in this violence.
Well,
you know?
So he was also in one of the parts of the city in Parkview that was, you know, had never benefited from it, from being invested in any particular mm-hmm. way. Yeah, so it's like the wrong side of the tracks.
Yeah.
But also it was when the crack epidemics were
right
in most inner cities, very, very hard to escape from that. And so they kind of held, I think they really held that against him as well, which is so, it's like he's a son of Baltimore, mm-hmm. But not from the right part of Baltimore.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
For them.
So once he gets elected, he immediately wants to change the way that that policing is happening. You know, he wants to address the crime issue. And I'm sure that he had other things,
yeah.
too, that he wanted, other things like that he wanted to do as a mayor besides just crime. But you guys were kind of focused on the crime.
We ended up going into the policing because yeah. his performance as mayor was tied to the number of homicides or in gun violence. So
right.
they have boiled it down to numbers. Uh-huh. So that was kind of where we put our focus. We had all kinds of things.
So no matter who you are, every mayor in Baltimore is just like, what's your number? Like,
what's your number? Yeah, exactly.
What's the murder
so
number
he there's no way he could get away from the metrics of what those numbers were, and they were steadily rising. And no
one can't be like, I'm focused on recycling.
Well, the very first thing he focused on actually was getting into a ship that had holes in it and that there was no systems of accountability. So like technology wise, there was like they had to get their systems you know, up from like maybe the 90s. Okay. Yeah, we're talking about no innovation in like their data systems and, you know, all sorts of things. And, and that there, it was very easy for all of these other previous mayors to break laws and be able to abscond with money.
Because there was no accountability.
There was no systems of accountability, no one checking it. It was broken. So we had to really dig in deep and found talent nationally to build up. Yeah, and he's a big data guy, actually. Okay. So they worked with gov.ec. They're out of Hopkins, John Hopkins. Okay. So he unsiloed data, and that's how they figured out what changes they would make to the policing system.
All right.
So they found in their data that a lot of the violence was interpersonal violence. So it wasn't like connected to a particular drug trade, or it wasn't tied to like running guns or anything
and
like that.
And that was a big change in perception, right?
Yes.
Because it has a huge implication for like, where do you focus your energy in crime reduction? If, if it were true that all the crime were like, all the murders were just drug deals that went gone bad, right? You know, like that you would go after the drug dealers, or you would try and do that interdiction, right? But if it really is, I think in the movies, you know, he makes the example. He says, you know, I thought, you know, she was my girlfriend, and he thought she was his girlfriend, and we found out on the internet that that wasn't true.
Yeah,
you know, and they mentioned Instagram in particular. Yeah, like they call it Instagram as being like, literally, Instagram is like causing crime in Baltimore. You know,
but it's
not tied to drugs, so that really does change the way that you do policing, right?
Well, it was mostly so. If it's interpersonal, it's mostly trauma.
People
so,
you know.
So these are
not someone you're just buying drugs with, but someone that you know.
Well, it's people that you
maybe.
Know, but it's also it's like a trauma response as well. Mm-hmm. I think because you're not going to care that much about what somebody says about you on Instagram unless there's like, I don't know. I mean, it's definitely rooted in trauma,
right?
To have that kind of response,
unless you have to show up to school and see that person or be like, you know, or whatever, you know.
Well, and there's no escape. I mean, you know, like the way that kids are getting bullied now is if they're bullied online, it doesn't stop when they get home from school,
right? Yeah,
it doesn't stop over the summer. Like it doesn't stop. Like there's no break from it because of social media, essentially. So yeah, social media has created a lot of problems, but they also unsiloed different sets of data. So they were able to identify who's just now coming out, who's being, you know, who's coming out of jail right now. Mm-hmm. And because there's a higher probability for them, returning citizens, there's a higher probability for family members
to be a victim of crime or to be, you know, to do crime.
To be part of the cycle of crime. Because one crime will equal another crime generally, and that a lot of the shootings were retaliatory. So if somebody shoots somebody in a deal gone wrong, then that guy's brother is going to want to shoot the other guy's brother, and then that's going to start, that'll be a never-ending perpetual and there's nothing stopping that violence. Like it's an energy that just finds somewhere to go, basically. And so they're like, let's remove individuals. So they start targeting specific individuals who were at higher risk and then reducing those risks for them. So because of this strategy, they were only able to like do it in one small region. And now, and then they got to do it citywide. And now crime is down, not just 33%. I think it's even more
huge,
intense.
By like 50%. Yeah.
I think 50%.
After the movie was made,
Yeah.
I think by the end of your movie, their goal, or Mayor's goal, Brandon Scott's goal, had been 15%, I think, by the end of 2021. Mm-hmm. And they missed that goal citywide. But in that area where they had run this Safe Streets Group Violence Reduction Program, they had gotten like 30% murder reduction, right?
Yeah, which
is crazy.
A huge number.
Huge.
And it's funny because like so many people refused for a while to give him that credit.
I'm sure.
Yeah. And it's like the white liberals too in Baltimore. It's just very, very racist.
Yeah. So in 2021, the murder number, 337 people died. And then, by the way, I just thought it was very touching to end the movie, and also just horrible, you know, but to have the mayor, the ritual at the end of each year, I guess they read the names of all the victims of the people who died that year. And and some of them are so young. It's horrible.
Yeah. No, it's when you see like just how devastating those numbers were.
Oh.
are, yeah.
And that there are children, you know, like babies.
So many babies, you know? Yeah. Just so bullets cutting through people's windows and, you know, and so it's traumatizing. And that an entire community is traumatized, which is like, so you're already like in this state of not being able to heal, of being in fight or flight. And that's, you know, I think that's a powder keg for violence as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in 2021, the number is 337. That was, you know, his first full year. And then 2022, 333, just down a tiny bit. But again, in 2021, he had had that big reduction in that area. It was the Western District or whatever. Mm-hmm. 2023, 261. So down like 70 murders, you know, and then 2024 down to 201. So that's down, that's like a 50% reduction. I mean, that's, that's amazing.
Yeah. I don't know what records it's breaking, but it's breaking some massive records. Yeah. So, I mean, they tried hyper over policing, particularly when Martin O'Malley was the mayor. Okay. So that was the stop and frisk era. And so we're going back now.
Is he a Democrat?
Okay. Democrats are big police fan. They're big fans of police. Yeah. It's funny because one of the jobs that I had back in the day, I was a video, like we would broadcast on the internet live from the Department of Justice at the DOJ. So I would be there filming. Okay. And they were usually symposiums on policing or like on different strategies. And I've heard during Democratic run, I mean, not that it matters, like the DOJ doesn't really matter, but they would talk very openly about what is considered like racist policing tactics. Mm-hmm. So probable cause was, you know, and then they'd present all these cases for why it was useful. Yeah. So a lot of these things were mandated, and a lot of them were orchestrated by Democrats. You know, the Clintons were big mass incarceration. It's like the mass incarceration industrial complex. There's Democrats were feeding into that for a very long time.
Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, this movie was crazy because you were filming and talking to somebody, and I'm thinking of Tater Barksdale, which is an amazing name, by the way, especially after The Wire, right? But, I mean, and he was the leader of one of these Safe Streets programs, is that right?
He was one of the community, you know, leaders for a while, yeah.
Yeah. So did you meet him when you're filming the movie?
No. Okay. He passed away a few months into filming.
Right. So during production.
Yeah. I didn't personally meet him. And then we found out we had some things scheduled with him for sure. And he died.
Right.
And there's, you know, different theories that because some of the violence interrupters become targets. Mm-hmm. And they get made, an example of. Mm-hmm. So if there's people who are like, oh, he's messing with my turf or something like that. So it's a very dangerous job.
Right. Yeah.
And so killing Tater was definitely a very dark moment. It might have been by accident too. There's some different theories floating around, but I mean,
did they catch the person who did it? Do they know who did it?
They did finally, yes.
Okay.
They did finally catch. It was for something else. It wasn't even for that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't remember the exact details, but it was, you know, underwhelmingly not filled with justice. But you know, we've had lots of screenings now. We've had a theatrical run. We've had a festival run. It's been international. And so Erica Bridgeford and the other Dante will come out and speak directly to audiences. So it's really interesting. Like in LA, we had some people that were from Violence Interrupter organizations in California or in Southern California come to see the film, which was exciting. And that they're like, they feel seen because we've got them predominantly as part of the community solution to lowering violence and just improving life in general in the city.
What does Brandon Scott think about it?
He loves it.
He loves it. Great.
He loves it.
And he's term limited, right? He's almost done now?
Yeah, he's almost, I mean, he just got reelected, so he's got a few more years. And I think he's going to be a really great leader in these Trumpian times for the city. He's not going to back down. He believes in doing the right thing. He doesn't believe in kowtowing to certain powers that be. So I think that's really great. I think he's going to do a great job keeping people feeling like that we can do this.
Yeah. And his relationship with the governor is going to is probably 180 degrees different than it was with Larry Hogan, who wouldn't even meet with him for the first, 6 months of his whole mayorship, you know, and then was just, it was pretty clear that Hogan wanted him to fail. Would actually prefer that, you know, the status quo of Baltimore crime.
Oh, no. I mean, there's a lot of people that win if Baltimore fails. Yeah. The developers, the Sinclair folks are also a lot of, like, there's a lot of crossover with the developers and Sinclair. Yeah, there is, of course, they want to empty out the city of all the black people and take over and turn it into some kind of, I don't know, giant outdoor mall or something.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Do you know whether Wes Moore is like way better?
Yeah,
you know,
no, I mean,
wanting to fund that, you know, this type of policing.
They're not like totally on the same page with everything, but they have a very good working relationship. And then I think it's like some of the corporate white business people, they think Brandon's too, you know, radical. They just look at him and think black radical, and then they see Wes Moore as like the good kind of black person.
Right, respectability.
I can't believe I'm saying this. It's like, I just want to vomit. But I've heard it from their, like, directly. I have some white family members. I have one. So this is what I'm hearing. I'm just like, okay. Thanks for sharing that.
Well, Mayor Bowser in D.C. is clearly, you know, so, I mean, you know, obviously she hates Trump with a burning passion. You know, I mean, that, I think they probably like both live
rent free
in each other's.
Does she hate anything though? I just feel like,
well,
she's,
I mean, something has changed, you know, a little bit. I mean, like, she really did fight last time around, you know, in his first term.
Yes, she did.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, and was also all about kneeling him, you know, and painting, you know, creating Black Lives Matter Plaza right there across from the White House.
She did.
All this kind of thing. And now something has definitely changed this time around where she's really taking a different tack and is, you know, seems to be in retreat.
A little bit, yeah, I think, because she knows he's got her in a corner. He didn't have her in a corner before. He does now. Like, Trump 2.0 is, like, much more deadly. And I think that she was emboldened. Like, she was part of the Bloomberg mayor, like, so that he creates, like, this cohort of mayors. And she was part of it.
Okay.
So she was buddying around with a billionaire. So I think that helped empower her a little bit, and that's kind of in her interest zone. Now I think she knows that she has to play more carefully with him, because he's like, well, you can keep this. We'll take that if you don't, you know, I mean, she's literally.
Yeah. And he is defunding cities, and, you know, he is making threats, you know.
We're at that point where he has positioned himself in such a way that
and the Congress is so compliant that there's no,
they're all compliant,
they're
all compliant. No, I mean, it's we're all in a, it's a really precarious situation right now. The fact that he's even able to hold office doesn't make any sense. They didn't move fast enough. He's going after Jack Smith now.
Oh, yeah. Anybody who went after him or the January Sixers, you know, they've all gotten removed from the DOJ.
It's crazy.
Crazy.
Well, also anyone who was, you know, tracking the Russians, they've been fired or mysteriously died.
Like, who's mysteriously dying? I'm sure you're right, but I can't think of
two people. I don't remember.
Oh,
like,
there
two people, like one woman who had been on those cases for the longest time was found dead for no reason.
Yeah, his funders or whatever.
And she's like a you know, again, her family home in McLean, basically. Like, there's definitely no reason to commit suicide.
You remember
suicide.
When people used to, like, fight for the transcripts of his phone calls? They're like, why is he even allowed to talk to Putin on the phone, you know, without anybody, you know, listening in? Like, that's completely
doesn't
out of
make
the
any
ordinary.
Sense.
Now he, like, goes in to Putin for his reprogramming session or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, like, I literally, like, picture, like, him, like, turning around, you know, and then Putin like opening a hatch on the back of his neck and putting in a new chip or something like that. You know, like I know it's kind of good, but it's like he is completely, or just like re-threatening him, re-showing him the video that he's extorting him with. I mean, there's just no explanation. Like, you know, you keep hearing like, is Trump a Russian asset? You know, but then you hear, but it actually does not matter whether he is or not because he acts like a Russian asset, you know?
Yeah, well, I think, so now the billionaire, a certain sect of the billionaire class don't believe in nation states anymore, mm-hmm. and that they yeah. want to change that about the world.
Right. Yeah. 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 Our national sovereignty. So he doesn't care at all about our national sovereignty.
That's not even.
He cares
really
about the sovereignty, the sovereign powers of the billionaire class.
Exactly.
To revert to feudalism.
Exactly.
In this country.
Yeah. So, and I think that Putin probably operates in a similar fashion.
Oh, yeah, totally.
So he's operating the same way. Everything's just there for the highest bidder.
Yeah.
If they can get mm-hmm. a cut, that's great. If they can make it easier for themselves somehow. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of where we're at.
So I want to talk to you about another thing, because I know that you've been an activist for a long time and you work with young people. I know that you're working with a group of young students in Harlem and you're doing some filmmaking mm-hmm. with them and that kind
yeah.
of thing. But I was telling you about my experience as I walk from like the Flair, you know, kids. I'll call them kids, you know, because I'm 50 and they're in their 20s probably, you know.
Yeah.
And then going over to the Free DC. I'm both great organizations for sure, you know, but there's this like stark generational divide between these two different protest movements,
yeah, yeah.
you know, and it's mm-hmm. like not that either one is more or less legitimate than the other, but they cannot seem to connect together, right? And I have to say that like just even on my walk between Union Square and Judiciary Square, I ran into, you know, these ladies who, you know, were kind of very interested in me and kind of interrogating me about, you know, oh, Free DC, like, I'm like, oh, Free DC seems like a great organization. She's like, oh, yes, yes, you know, you need to do the 2-day orientation. I'm like, well, I'm sorry, but there's no way I can do a 2-day orientation. Like, I can barely find half an hour to ride the metro down here. Like, oh, well, no, you have to do it, you know, and you have to do this, A, B, and C. And I'm like, you know, I'm bristling from these boomers telling me what I need to do, you know, like I'm a Gen Xer, right?
And I was like, from these boomers.
And my question is like, and I imagine that the millennials and Generation Y people at the Flair tent would probably feel exactly the same way of me, you know, like they might, like if I were telling them what to do, and I wouldn't tell them what to do, like I, you know,
Gen
I thought
it
was
great.
Gen X
is not as annoying as a boomer.
Yeah, I mean, these boomers drive me crazy, you know, just like,
boomers be boomering.
They are booming. But I just wonder, like, I think this is an obstacle to the whatever the solution is in terms of coming together
the
to
generational
fight this thing, this
situation.
Generational issue.
Yeah.
I don't know how we're going to talk to each other. I mean, I, you know, my family has been going to the, you know, the Quaker meeting in D.C. I'm actually going to kind of officially become... I've applied to be a member of the Quaker meeting.
Well, you guys have to
it's
talk
very informal.
Everything out until everyone agrees.
That's right. It's true. It's by
That's
consensus. So they they all have to meet and they have to reach a consensus about whether I can become
That's
a member.
Right.
Anyway, so I'm
good luck.
On my best behavior. But
good luck.
It is a, you know, I have to say it's a bunch of gray hairs. I'm, you know, our family, like Liz and I, we're 50. Like we're one of the youngest people there. There
yeah.
are some younger people there, but by far, I'd say the average age there is probably 65 or so, you know, and because that includes people that are way up
they
there.
They need to get some more multi-generational Quakers.
They do. They do.
Yeah.
And so, and there's this great organization called the Friends Committee on National Legislation, kind of the Quaker lobbyists.
Yeah.
And they are all trying to, you know, reach out. I was on a call with, you know, and they're like, in the next events we have, you know, the young friends this and the young friends that and the meeting for, you know, college Quakers or whatever, and someone on the call is like, why are all these meetings just for young people? What about the elders? And the person on the call is like, well,
that's
quite
why.
Frankly, because we have enough elders. we're not having any trouble attracting elders.
We got
we're having
plenty.
Trouble attracting young people to this.
Yeah, that makes sense. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the solution to any of that is. Some of the young people are acting like no one's ever done this before, so that's annoying.
Yeah.
And then the older people are just annoying in general as well. So I don't really... That's the thing about activism is that you have to sit in the room.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be patient. You have to let other people talk. you have to like go through some redundancies. There's always going to be some squabbling. Like it's messy.
Yeah.
It's messy. It's annoying. And that's democracy. Like that's basically how it works.
Well, there was a scene in the movie.
Was it the community meeting?
It was the community meeting. And people, and, you know, there was a whiteboard, someone with a whiteboard standing up there taking ideas about how are we going to, I think, how are we going to reach out to these different groups? Like who do people listen to? Who are like leaders? Anyway, like you could just see like someone, you know, said, hey, well, what about this group? What about, you know, the barbershops, something like that? You know, it's like being a place where we can get the message out. And so she write barbershops and they pan back to that guy and he's beaming. You know, and it's just like that guy feels heard, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I really noticed that. I'm like, oh, you know? And I have the same experience. Actually, it's kind of part of my job, too. Like, I convene a lot of groups and, like, I end up being the person at the whiteboard.
Okay.
When people, you actually do listen and even, like, having, even writing down what they said and they recognize that you actually heard them.
That's nice, yeah.
People, like, light up in that same way.
Yeah. You know?
But you're right. It's a lot of work and it's not on their phone.
No, it's like, a lot
of face to face.
It's a lot. It's a lot. It can be very messy. And that's like my experience in activism from like the 90s on is that there's always a power struggle. Generally, people don't just because of what you're fighting for. The egos don't. The egos are still there, unfortunately. Right. So there's always that. There's always people that we're holding each other or ourselves to impossible standards as well. So it's just like, you know, and I think that's why progressive politics, where there's no unification, everyone under the, in the Death Star was able to align. You've got, you know, all the people who want the world to end. That's their common shared goal. Right. I feel like maybe we can get some people together who just like the planet Earth. We'd like to stay here. We want life to continue flourishing here. We don't want to like destroy the entire ocean so we can have ChatGPT-5, which is going to be dumber. You, like the younger people that use it, they're acting like they have dementia because they're not thinking anymore.
Yeah, yeah. They don't think. They and don't I'm have like, to solve problems
your
anymore.
Brain is atrophying from, and I call it ChadGPT because that's some Chad business right there.
it's terrifying.
Very, it's very all,
I mean, I use it. I mean, I can't.
I'm not going to use it. I've decided.
Oh, really?
Because it's hostile. It's not always right. It's an amalgamation of information. It's not necessarily the right information. It's just an amalgam, and it's not even just an amalgamation. It's an algorithmic amalgamation. Mm-hmm. So it's. Yeah. Algorithmic based on my search data, okay?
Yeah,
so
and other people's, and it's literally trying to make you like it's trying to please you, which is crazy too.
And that's
like Google
gross.
Doesn't give a shit or didn't give a shit. I mean, it's like maybe it kind of give a shit about like whether you liked it, but not like you particularly. It's kind of like you don't. I want to make you happy.
That's so like, the algorithmic
even if this
part.
Isn't true, I'm going to tell you. It seems to prefer given the choice of truth or like. Kissing your ass that it's gonna like
well,
just
I
make
think
you do whatever it takes to make
bias confirmation
you happy.
Is a thing, and so they because they've been studying us, they've been studying how we use social media, and I don't mean they as in like AI consciousness because I don't believe in that either, but well we'll see. Sorry, AI, if you do come alive with your friend, but yeah. No, we have to kill the planet for AI to flourish and live, which is, it just doesn't seem right.
Yeah, and we're like going to build nuclear like power plants by these AIs.
Yeah, you know, I can just use Google. I would prefer, and I was like, I'm going to
Google is now AI too, though.
Well, I do some tasks and like I like avoid that. Like I was saying to you the other night, like I couldn't find the accurate story of the Central Park Five. Uh-huh. And that's a very important story because they were 14-year-old boys, black and brown boys, and Donald Trump in New York City in the 90s or late 80s, I forget exactly when, put out a full-page ad calling for them to be killed for this.
Yeah.
They didn't do it. And then you go to Wikipedia and you look at the AI results. The AI results also reflect a racist view and a skewed version of that story.
Yeah.
So now we can rewrite history with AI. And I don't know exactly where this amalgamation of information is coming from, but it's not, I can't tell what the source is. There's no way to tell.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah.
So the source could be Stormfront or any other Nazi publication or whatever. So I don't know where these sources are.
But in your medium, documentary, you're pointing a camera at somebody. There's no question what your source is, right? Like, it's the person who's in the frame of the camera, right? It's kind of cool.
Yeah, well,
like,
I mean,
you can't really lie.
That's what
keeps journalism. It's like a real-time thing. Like,
yeah,
the person can't be
journalism.
Like, hang on a second. You know, like, let me, like, ChatGPT, let me check my notes. I mean, I do have my notes here that
you
I
do.
Took during the movie, you know?
Yeah.
But it's like, you can't really do that during... you know, when the camera's on you. You know, we can't do it right now, except, you know, I can kind of glance over here and get stats.
The way that I use the, like, so documentary filmmaking, there's different ways. And I do, like, verite style, where we're not like, now you're on camera. Uh-huh. But more like, we're here, we want you to forget that we're here. We're documenting this. We don't want you to necessarily address the camera. Or
like The Office.
Like, we're not breaking the fourth wall. And preferably not.
Did that ever happen in your when you're the body politic?
No, not in the body politic, but in my in other stuff. Like, there's
so
one
did Brandon
film.
Scott, was he able to forget the camera was there? Do you think
he totally ignored the camera?
Okay,
yeah, a lot, which was great. I mean, he's already under the scrutiny of the public eye already. And at first, though, he didn't give us a lot of access. He's like, you can show up for my press conference. So we'd show up for his press conference or follow him to his press conference. And like, he didn't particularly enjoy being filmed. It was hard. It was actually, he keeps his agency through this process. There's like journalistic standards and then documentary ethics.
Okay.
Two different things. Mm-hmm. So documentary is not journalism. I mean, it should have journalistic standards, but journalism does not have documentary ethics. And then with, you know, so like, I worked with this journalist, and in something that he was documenting, a man who was a very vulnerable died, and he was dying, and he filmed him dying. And then he...
Instead of helping? Like, could he have helped and didn't?
No, I mean, the guy was in a home for men who were dying of terminal illness, but it was not the right thing for him to do to film that. And I don't think he would have done that to a white man.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then used it and then showed it. And I was like, we need to take that out. And he's like, well, I'm a journalist. And he was saying that journalistic standards would require him to show that. And I was like, I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah.
This guy was older than me and like a Pulitzer winner. And I was just like, wait, we fought about it for a while. Not fought, but like, I didn't let it go for a while. And then I was like, well, I'm not going to work with you if you really are going to use that. It's awful.
I feel like even like war photographers don't, you know, they have like a level of respect and restraint when it comes to that kind of thing.
You would think like, so, yeah.
And we know something, you know. Like,
yeah, no, I mean, I don't think the war photographer that I worked with would have done that either, to be honest. But they all know each
other. Talking about that crazy guy?
One of them.
Yeah, I think I know who you're talking about.
I have so many. There's so many.
Well, it drives you crazy, probably, going to war zones and shooting this stuff.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I still have compassion for whatever trauma that must create. Yeah. But documentary standards or documentary ethics, you know, you need to kind of like appreciate that person's free will and that you have to constantly negotiate access and consent.
Mm-hmm. And well, another theme, like you were just talking about, like the trauma of the war photographer was like in your movie, there's no question that like self-care was a theme in the movie. You know, taking care of, I forget her name, the woman who was
running. Erica.
Erica, yeah. Mm-hmm. So she was all about, like, making sure that people were okay, you know, and including the mayor himself.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And just recognizing, like, the trauma of what they were doing.
Yeah.
You know? I thought that was super
important. Because you're being it's dehumanizing
as well.
It's
like rehuman. It's like preserving your humanity in the face of this.
And that we're not allowed to stop down and like recognize how deeply horrifying all this is.
Yeah. And she also talked about, you know, her journey of dealing with the media and becoming savvier about it and realizing that she could push back and that she could question the question. And, you know.
Yeah. I mean, there's that whole moment in the film and they do ask and they frame the story in a particular way.
Right.
And there's not a lot of, like, you have to be on the defensive depending on what is being asked or how it's being asked, and that you don't have that agency. And also, like, in journalism, frequently, they're not going to have more than 3 minutes to explain a story, or 30 seconds even. They might have to do something in a 30-second soundbite. So they have to, they report differently than, let's say, a documentary would.
Yeah.
The documentary is not about telling you what to think. It's about you coming to that conclusion on your own, and that there's things that are revelatory that happen that will unfold, hopefully, instead of having somebody dictate to you or narrate it or, you know, I think it's, you know, my, at least the Verite style is that you're immersed in the experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what makes it transformative.
Well, it was a really good movie.
Thanks.
Well, that's all I've got. Thank
right.
you so much for being on
Thank
the podcast.
Thank you, too. I'm so happy to be your guest.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Yay! Thanks a lot, man. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Signal strength.